2. Before Bacteria and Bach. Why Bach? To get a sound perspective on our history, we actually have to go back to the time before bacteria, before life in any form existed, since some of the demands on getting life going at all send important echoes down the eons to explain features of our minds today. And, before turning to that story, let me pause to draw attention to one word, Bach. I could have chosen From Archaea to Shakespeare, or From E. coli to Einstein, or perhaps From Prokaryotes to Picasso, but the alliteration of bacteria to Bach proved irresistible. What about the glaring fact that all the candidates I just considered in my pantheon of great minds are men? What an awkward stumble out of the starting blocks. Do I really want to alienate many listeners at the outset? What was I thinking? I did it on purpose, to provide a relatively mild and simple example of one variety of the gravitational forces of Cartesian gravity we will deal with. If you bristled when you noticed my all-male roster of genius, then good. That means you won't forget that I've taken out a loan on your patience, to be repaid at some later time in the book. Bristling, like any acute emotional reaction from fear to amusement, is a sort of boldface for your memory, making the offending item less likely to be forgotten. At this point, I ask you to resist the urge to launch a preemptive strike. Throughout our journey, we will need to identify uncomfortable facts without indulging in premature explanations or rebuttals. While I delight in having listeners who are not only paying close attention but also way ahead of me, I would much prefer that you bide your time, cutting me some slack, giving me enough rope to hang myself, if you like, instead of trying to derail my attempt at a calm, objective account with your premonitions. So let's stand down, pause, and review a few plain facts, leaving the explanations and refutations for later. It is an obvious fact that although there have been many brilliant women of great attainment, none of them has achieved the iconic status of Aristotle, Bach, Copernicus, Dickens, Einstein. I could easily list a dozen more men in the same league. But try for yourself to think of a great female thinker who could readily displace any of these men in playing the emblematic role in my title. My favorites would be Jane Austen, Marie Curie, Ada Lovelace, and Hypatia of Alexandria. I doubt I've overlooked any obvious candidates, but time will tell. There have not yet been any female superstar geniuses. What might explain this fact? Political oppression? The self-fulfilling sexist prophecies that rob young girls of inspiring role models? Media bias over the centuries? Genes? Please don't jump to conclusions even if you think the answer is obvious. I don't. We will soon see that genes, though essential players in the history of mind, are nowhere near as important as many like to think. Genes may account for basic animal competence, but genes don't account for genius. Moreover, the traditional view of great human societies owing their greatness to the creative brilliance of some of their inhabitants is, I will try to show, just about backward. Human culture itself is a more fecund generator of brilliant innovations than any troop of geniuses of either gender. This it achieves by a process of cultural evolution that is as much the author of our finest achievements as any individual thinker is. The very idea that evolution by natural selection might have a foundational role to play in understanding human culture fills some people, even wise and thoughtful people, with loathing. They see human culture as something transcendent, the miraculous endowment that distinguishes us human beings from the beasts, the last bulwark against creeping reductionism, against genetic determinism, against the philistinism they think they see in contemporary science. And in reaction to these culture vultures, there are hard-nosed scientists to whom any appeal to culture smells of mystery-mongering, or worse. When I hear the word culture, I reach for my gun. Now I must ask both sides to holster their guns and be patient. There is a middle ground that can do justice to the humanities and science at the same time, explaining how human culture got up and running by a process of evolution of cultural items, memes, that invaded human brains the way viruses invade human bodies. Yes, memes have not been shown to be a bad idea, and they will get their day in court in this book. Those on both sides who scoff and hoot at the idea of memes will see that there are good objections to memes, in addition to the flawed refutations that have been uncritically accepted by many who just can't stand the idea. But these good objections point to refinements that save the concept of memes after all. So whose side am I on? Listeners intent on framing the issue in these terms have missed the point. This polarization of visions, with cheering, hissing spectators egging on the combatants, is just a conveniently obvious first manifestation of the forces I am trying to render visible to all and neutralize. There is much more to come, subtler and more insidious pressures on the thinking of scientists, philosophers, and laypeople alike. Now back to my first pass at the story. How investigating the prebiotic world is like playing chess. The simplest, earliest life form capable of reproducing itself, something like a bacterium, was already a breathtakingly complex and brilliantly designed self-maintaining system. Hang on, did I just give aid and comfort to the intelligent design crowd? No. But how can a good materialist, atheist Darwinian like me, keep a straight face while declaring the earliest reproducing life forms to be brilliantly designed? Hold your fire. A well-known chicken-and-egg problem beloved by the intelligent design folks challenges us to undo the paradox of the origin of life. Evolution by natural selection couldn't get started until there were reproducing things, since there would be no offspring to inherit the best designs. But the simplest reproducing thing is much too complex to arise by mere chance. So, it is claimed, evolution cannot get started without a helping hand from an intelligent designer. This is a defective argument, a combination of misdirection and failure of imagination, as we shall see. But we should concede the truly striking fact that the first concoction of molecules capable of reliably reproducing itself was, must have been, an engineering marvel, composed of thousands of complex parts working together. For researchers working on the origin of life, this poses a straightforward challenge. How could this possibly come about without a miracle? Perhaps an intelligent designer from another galaxy was responsible, but this would just postpone the question and make it harder to address. The way to proceed is clear. Start with the minimal specification for a living, reproducing thing, a list of all the things it has to be able to do, and work backward, making an inventory of the available raw materials, often called the feedstock molecules of prebiotic chemistry, and asking what sequence of possible events could gradually bring together, non-miraculously, all the necessary parts in the right positions to accomplish the job. Notice that this minimal specification lists what the thing must do, a list of functions, not a list of parts and materials. A mousetrap has to trap mice, and a can opener has to open cans, and a living thing has to capture energy and protect or repair itself long enough to reproduce. How could such a living thing possibly arise? If you can answer this question, you win, rather like achieving checkmate in chess. This is a huge undertaking, with many gaps still to fill. But every year there are encouraging breakthroughs, so confidence runs high that the task can be done, the game can be won. There may actually be many ways life could possibly have arisen out of non-life, but finding just one that deserves scientific allegiance, until a better alternative is discovered, would muffle the impossible in principle choir for good. However, finding even one way is a task so daunting that it has fueled the conviction among researchers that even though the processes that must be invoked to create the end product are utterly blind and purposeless, the product itself is not just intricate, but stunningly effective at what it does. A brilliant design. It takes all the ingenuity human reverse engineers can muster to figure out how the thing got assembled. A commentary by Jack Szostak, one of the leading researchers on one of the biggest breakthroughs of recent years, illustrates this attitude perfectly. For 40 years, efforts to understand the prebiotic synthesis of the ribonucleotide building blocks of RNA have been based on the assumption that they must have assembled from their three molecular components: a nucleobase, which can be adenine, guanine, cytosine, or uracil, a ribose sugar, and phosphate. Of the many difficulties encountered by those in the field, the most frustrating has been the failure to find any way of properly joining the pyrimidine nucleobases, cytosine and uracil, to ribose. But Pauner et al. Revived the prospects of the RNA-first model by exploring a pathway for pyrimidine ribonucleotide synthesis in which the sugar and nucleobase emerge from a common precursor. In this pathway, the complete ribonucleotide structure forms without using free sugar and nucleobase molecules as intermediates. This central insight, combined with a series of additional innovations, provides a remarkably efficient solution to the problem of prebiotic ribonucleotide synthesis. Greg Meyer, an evolutionary biologist commenting on this, makes an important point. John Sutherland, one of Pauner's co-authors, and in whose lab the work was done, worked on the problem for 12 years before he found the solution. What if he had given up after 10? Could we have concluded that no synthesis was possible? No. This work demonstrates the futility of all the various sorts of arguments. The arguments from design, the god of the gaps, the argument from personal incredulity that rely on ignorance as their chief premise. Throughout this book, I will exploit the perspective of reverse engineering, taking on the premise that every living thing is a product of non-mysterious physical processes that gradually brought all the elements together, refining them along the way, and eventually arrived at the working system we observe, or at some hypothesized intermediate system, a stepping stone that would represent clear progress toward the living things we know exist. The cascade of processes must make changes that we can see, in retrospect, to be improvements in the design of the emerging systems. We're on the way to checkmate. Are we making progress? Until there were systems that could be strictly called reproducing systems, the processes at work were only proto-evolutionary, semi-Darwinian, partial analogs of proper evolution by natural selection. They were processes that raised the likelihood that various combinations of ingredients would arise and persist, concentrating the feedstock molecules until this eventually led to the origin of life. A living thing must capture enough energy and materials and fend off its own destruction long enough to construct a good enough replica of itself. The reverse engineering perspective is ubiquitous in biology and is obligatory in investigations of the origin of life. It always involves some kind of optimality considerations. What is the simplest chemical structure that could possibly do X? Or would phenomenon X be stable enough to sustain process Y? In a highly influential essay, Stephen Jay Gould and Richard Lewontin coined the phrase Panglossian paradigm as a deliberately abusive term for the brand of biology, adaptationism, that relies on the methodological principle of assuming, until proven otherwise, that all the parts of an organism are good for something. That is, they have useful roles to play, such as pumping blood, improving speed of locomotion, fending off infection, digesting food, dissipating heat, attracting mates, and so forth. The assumption is built right into the reverse engineering perspective that sees all living things as efficiently composed of parts with functions. There are well-recognized exceptions, for instance, features that used to be good for something and are now vestigial, along for the ride unless they are too expensive to maintain, and features that have no actual function but just drifted to fixation by chance. Gould and Lewontin's joke was a recycled caricature. In Candide, Voltaire created Dr. Pangloss, a wickedly funny caricature of the philosopher Leibniz, who had maintained that our world was the best of all possible worlds. In Dr. Pangloss's overfertile imagination, there was no quirk, no deformity, no catastrophe of nature that couldn't be seen in retrospect to have a function, to be a blessing, just what a benevolent God would arrange for us, the lucky inhabitants of the perfect world. Venereal disease, for instance, is indispensable in this best of worlds. For if Columbus, when visiting the West Indies, had not caught this disease, which poisons the source of generation, which frequently even hinders generation, and is clearly opposed to the great end of nature, we should have neither chocolate nor cochineal. Leibniz scholars will insist, with some justice, that Voltaire's parody is hugely unfair to Leibniz, but leave that aside. Was Gould and Lewontin's reuse of the idea an unfair caricature of the use of optimality assumptions in biology? Yes, and it has had two unfortunate effects. Their attack on adaptationism has been misinterpreted by some evolution dreaders as tantamount to a refutation of the theory of natural selection, and it has convinced many biologists that they should censor not only their language, but also their thinking, as if reverse engineering was some sort of illicit trick they should shun, if at all possible. Those working on the origin of life have ignored the Pangloss critique of their methods, knowing that their strategic assumptions serve to direct the investigation away from fruitless wandering. There is no point in looking at chemical reactions that couldn't possibly generate a target structure presumed to be a necessary component. Admittedly, there are risks to this strategy, as Zostack notes. For years, the researchers made the mistaken assumption that the obviously best, most efficient way of uniting the nucleobases to the ribose was directly, and they overlooked the more devious path of having the ribonucleotide emerge from a common precursor, without involving the intermediate steps that had seemed necessary. In chess, a gambit is a strategy that gives up material, a step backward it seems, in order to take a better forward step from an improved position. When trying to calculate what your opponent is going to do, gambits are hard to spot, since they seem at first to be losing moves that can be safely ignored, since one's opponent is not that stupid. The same risk of ignoring devious but fruitful trails besets the reverse engineer in biology, since, as Francis Crick famously said, enunciating what he called Orgel's second rule, evolution is cleverer than you are. The uncanny way the blind, purposeless churn of evolution, including prebiotic chemical evolution, uncovers off-the-wall solutions to problems is not evidence for an intelligent designer, nor is it grounds for abandoning reverse engineering, which would mean giving up the inquiry altogether. It is grounds for persisting and improving your reverse engineering game. As in chess, don't give up. Learn from your mistakes and keep on exploring as imaginatively as you can, bearing in mind that your hypotheses, however plausible, still risk disconfirmation, which should be conscientiously sought. Here is an example of a possible gambit in the origin of life. It is initially tempting to assume that the very first living thing capable of reproducing must have been the simplest possible living thing, given the existing conditions on the planet at the time. First things first, make the simplest replicator you can imagine, and then build on that foundation. But this is by no means necessary. It is possible, and more likely, I think, that a rather inelegantly complicated, expensive, slow, Rube Goldberg conglomeration of objets trouvés was the first real replicator, and after it got the replication ball rolling, this ungainly replicator was repeatedly simplified in competition with its kin. Many of the most baffling magic tricks depend on the audience not imagining the ridiculously extravagant lengths magicians will go to in order to achieve a baffling effect. If you want to reverse engineer magicians, you should always remind yourself that they have no shame, no abhorrence of bizarre expenditures for tiny effects that they can then exploit. Nature similarly has no shame, and no budget, and all the time in the world. Talk of improvements or progress in the slow, uncertain process of biogenesis is not indulging in illicit value judgments, which have no place in science, let's agree, but is rather an acknowledgement of the ever-present requirements of stability and efficiency in anything living. If you like, you can imagine biochemists working on how something utterly terrible might come into existence, a doomsday device or self-replicating death ray. They would still have to discipline their search by imagining possible paths to construct this horror. And they might well marvel at the brilliance of the design they finally figured out. I will have more to say about the presuppositions and implications of reverse engineering in biology later. Here I hope to forestall premature dismissal of my project by any who has been persuaded, directly or by hearsay, that Gould and Lewontin's propaganda against adaptationism was fatal, contrary to the opinion widely engendered by their famous essay. Adaptationism is alive and well. Reverse engineering, when conducted with due attention to the risks and obligations, is still the royal road to discovery in biology and the only path to discovery in the demanding world of prebiotic chemistry of the origin of life. Next, I want to look at the phenomenon of the origin of life from a more philosophical perspective, as the origin of reasons. Is there design in nature, or only apparent design? If we consider evolutionary biology to be a species of reverse engineering, does this imply that there are reasons for the arrangements of the parts of living things? Whose reasons? Or can there be reasons without a reasoner? Designs without a designer?